This is The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Can you tell a climate change story in 7 minutes? The NOAA program, Pacific RESA, which stands for Regional Integrated Sciences and Assessments, believes you can. The group released its latest in their Climate Matters Docu-Moments series. This one focuses on the impacts on West Maui from ridge to reef. The first half of the video features Chris Brosius of the West Maui Mountain Watershed Partnership. Tova Callender from the West Maui Ridge to Reef Initiative is in the second half. We met up earlier today to talk about the project and what led to her organization's involvement.
The West Maui Ridge to Reef Initiative had been working with East-West Center for some time on some of the other climate-related projects they were doing. And so when they came to do this docu-moment, it was natural for them to reach out to us to partner.
When you talk about a docu-moment, I mean, it's a cute idea and concept, but you're still talking about 7 minutes. 7 minutes to tell a story that a lot of people may think they know something about in some ways, but not the specifics of what is happening on Maui that would make it universally appealing. How do you boil down all of that information about what has been happening on Maui from ridge to reef and put it into 7 minutes?
Part of it was definitely through the talent of the film team involved. They were able to bring in B-roll that really illustrated a lot of the things we were talking about much more effectively than if we were just talking about them without the images. So I think that was a big part of it.
Did you sit down to be able to look at how you were going to be able to consolidate all that information into 7 minutes? What was part of the process in doing that?
We started by going through a series of questions that they were interested in us exploring. And then from there, they switched into sort of a talk story format that captured a lot more of the human part of what both Chris and I were feeling about what was going on in the area. And I think those two pieces working together along with the visuals made it so we could make a pretty impactful message, even in that really short format.
What was it about the storytelling that elicited more emotion for you or more response that would hopefully bring about the same kind of feeling in the people watching the film?
When it came to talking more specifically about what I had noticed and the experience that I had and kind of reflecting on having my nephews out with me and seeing that the world is changing and not being okay with that.
Yeah. I'm watching you get very misty over all of that. And I know how deeply you feel about all of this. So what have you been noticing that brought such an impact to your nephews and to you?
Climate change has brought coral bleaching, which I'm sure you've heard about a lot about here in the state. In 2014 and 2015, a lot of the reefs that we know and love and need and we're hoping to have through the future died and didn't recover. And so in some areas where 3 years ago I could take the boys in and take them out to the reef and show them how amazing it is, you now have to swim so far offshore, this is in Oluwalu in this case, that I wouldn't take them because it's just too far. You have to go until you can get to an area that's not impacted. And these are changes that become pretty permanent. It's a tipping point. It moves in one direction. And it's not like another environmental situation where you can go back and plant more trees or restore. If you haven't dealt with what's causing the decline in the reef, you can't just come in and stick more reef in. Of course, there are great efforts to do that in the cases that are different, where they don't have all the other problems coming from the land and coming from climate change. But in our cases in West Maui, things have been impacted badly, and we need to not feel despair, as is so easy to do about this pace of change and kind of switch to looking at, okay, what can we do that can get us out of bed every day and not feel overwhelmed with the scale of what's happening.
As you were talking about tipping points with the reef, did you find others that were more up on the ridge as well?
Chris talks a bit about this in his segment. There is definitely, there's a switch happening. There's a lot more vulnerability to wildfire that's coming with climate change. And there are areas way up in the watershed where it's pristine that we previously thought couldn't be impacted by things like wildfire moving its way through. And that's not the case. So there are changes happening everywhere. And then, of course, you know, the weedy species move in. It's very hard to get it back to what it was. And then you don't have all those environmental benefits of that pristine environment.
Because it's no longer pristine.
Right, right. It's not absorbing water and filtering and infiltrating in the way that it was before.
When you say that it's hard not to feel despair about this, clearly that's something I can see in you as you're talking about this, but how do you then say, here we are at these tipping points, maybe there will be a way of getting some of the reefs back, maybe there won't. How do you continue from this point on? And also with something in this kind of a format, is this going to make enough of an impact with the people watching it to help you make whatever difference you can?
I don't know what the impact will be, but you can be hopeful that perhaps some people hadn't really made the connection. Not everyone gets their head underwater and sees what's going on. And so you can hear about it, but once you start seeing images of those changes, perhaps it's enough to prompt some people to understand the urgency and to look at what they're doing in their daily lives on land. And remember what we all know, water flows downhill and it's carrying whatever we're doing with it. And so that's the part where, well, you do have a role to play. There's all the suite of behaviors and related to climate change that we have the option to take. And then there's the specific things anywhere that you're living or working to try and reduce the amount of pollution making its way down to the ocean.
So to remind people about what those might be, what are they?
If you're a private citizen, make sure you clean up after your dog. Don't allow overspray. Think about any chemicals that you're applying. Watch what's happening with the weather before you decide to put something down. If you are a landowner, you have other options. If you're a developer, you have more still. Try and incorporate low-impact design so the stormwater infiltrates and cleans rather than just picks up speed and picks up more pollution as it heads to the ocean. There's really no, for every class of stakeholder we have, there are things we can do. If you're a decision maker, make those decisions that are needed to keep the soil and the pollutants on the land rather than allowing for practices in relation to construction and planning and development that don't do that.
A through line to all of what you just said seems to be don't mess with the topography of the land.
And if you do, make sure you do so in a way that you're thinking about how you might make a more inspired place by bringing back some of what nature does best, which is putting those elements in so that you can have catchment and filtration and hold things in place. Because, of course, yes, it would be great to say, please don't mess with the topography of the land, but it's not realistic. So it's perhaps better to look at how can we partner in a more inspired vision for our landscapes going forward. Because that is really one of the places where there's the biggest opportunity.
Specifically in that opportunity, what would you ask people to do? Because you just talked about catchment, you talked about what kind of landscaping you might do, but what specifics are you hoping that people will take away and import into how they're living their lives or how they're maintaining their homes or building new units? What would you ask them to do?
Well, the seed behind it all is remembering that everything we do on land has an impact on the ocean. And if that becomes your underlying thought, then as you're out there washing your car on the concrete and having the water pick up everything that's accumulated on the street and bringing it straight to the ocean, perhaps you'll remember that is the same drop that's going to be on the reef and creating impacts there. So it's a suite of behaviors. And unfortunately, the reefs are suffering from a number of different, you know, it's the death of a thousand cuts. So it's a suite of behaviors, but your personal polluted footprint is one part of it. Of course, reef-friendly sunscreens is something that's fairly accessible to people to make that change in their lives. And then in any sort of larger management of land, really trying to do those things that are going to keep the soil and any inputs that you have in place.
Because runoff is such an issue that we've been talking about for a very long time. And we've also been told, do what you can do. That's essentially the message that you're saying, which also seems to come through this docu-moment with a lot of images of what's happening because we weren't as careful in past. What will be enough for you with this effort and with the efforts that you and your organization are trying to bring to West Maui?
Well, that's a tricky question, because what is enough? We have a certain suite of behaviors that are in our control, those of us who are here on the land and in the nearshore area. And hopefully enough will be that people bring that awareness thread through, and it's not an afterthought. Whether or not the changes we make will be fast enough to prevent what's potentially coming with climate change is another story. So it's hard to say.
Thank you so much, Tova Callender.
Thanks for having me.
Tova Callender of the West Maui Ridge to Reef Initiative appears in the new docu-moment produced by NOAA's Pacific RESA program housed at the East-West Center. The short video, Climate Matters for Ridge to Reef Ecosystems, shows climate change impacts in West Maui. The link to it is on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the rhythms of Brazil live in our studio. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're remembering an American businessman who made his fortune in 19th century Hawaii. He was born in Glens Falls, New York, in 1822 and came to the islands when he was 24 years old. He rose quickly in local society, becoming a citizen of the kingdom and marrying into the royal house of Kamehameha within a few years of his arrival. His connections helped him in many business ventures, which included a Kauai sugar plantation and the first chartered bank in the kingdom. Today, that bank is known as First Hawaiian Bank, the second oldest bank west of the Rockies. Between 1859 and 1891, he served five different Hawaiian monarchs as a member of their Privy Council. He was also instrumental in the founding of two schools and a museum, and today we're looking for his name. And as you're listening to the rebroadcast of The Conversation, no one will be available to take your call if you are trying to answer the backyard quiz, but you can always call us when we're live in the 11 o'clock hour.
Aloha. I'm Tim Delaney, President of the National Council of Nonprofits, and you're listening to The Conversation, a member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Bossa Nova, the new thing, caused a quiet revolution in popular music when it came to America in the 60s. Powered by the brilliant songs and performances of artists like Antonio Carlos Jobim, Luis Bonfa, and Joao Gilberto, those songs are timeless and they're part of the musical palette of the band Mango Season, coming to our Atherton studio this Saturday. Curtis Camilla is the leader and Annie Camilla, the vocalist in Mango Season. They're with us in our studio. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Oh, thank you.
It is our pleasure.
Thank you for
to be
having
here.
Us.
Curtis, what was the original drive to do this band?
That's a great question. When I grew up in Hawaii and moved away to the mainland, went to college, met Annie, we got married, and we moved back about 10 years ago, started playing live, and needed someone else to sing with. I knew she was a singer, obviously. That's why we got together, and she was musical. I kind of convinced her to join the band. Mm-hmm. And then once she joined, we really had an identity because the band is really a joining of what we love. Annie's a jazz singer. I don't want to speak for you, but I will. Annie's a jazz singer. She loves soul. She loves kind of Ella Fitzgerald, stuff like that, and, sure. and bossa nova. And I would say that I'm a fan of soul and funk, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Chicago, mm-hmm. and then local music, Kalapana, Cecilia and Gopono, stuff like that.
Well, Annie, as a jazz singer, was it the transition to bossa nova, the feel of bossa nova, was that easy? Was it difficult?
No, it wasn't difficult at all. In fact, the jazz that I grew up with that I most love was the scatting of like Ella Fitzgerald. So mm-hmm. when I started to listen to bossa nova, and I started listening to it very early with my grandmother, actually, and she turned me on to Sergio Mendes and Jobim mm-hmm. and Lonnie Hall and the Brazil 66. And I found that the rhythm had a lot of scatting to it, or just felt like it had a lot of that scatting feel to it. And so it felt very, very natural. And I just mm-hmm. I think partially I fell in love with it because my grandmother loved it so much. So every time I listen to it, I have her in the back of my head.
I really think that some of our strongest musical influences come when we're first getting exposed yeah. to music in mm-hmm. In the teenage years, especially. Was that way for you?
Yeah, I mean, I can remember my grandmother used to take care of us after school. So she had a record player, and that was the first thing we did. As soon as I got no TV, I couldn't watch TV, but I could listen to her records. Mm-hmm. So she just put on, you know, she'd put on Herb Alpert, and then she'd put on Jobim, and then she'd put on Sergio Mendes, and we just dance in her kitchen. So I have really fond memories of it, and I always loved to sing. So, and she'd let me sing at the top of my lungs in her
yeah.
kitchen. So I think it has really good memories to it. So whenever I sing it, it has such a fondness and a warmness.
Yeah.
I just fall back in love with it.
I think that has a lot to do with why we love the music we mm-hmm. love, you know, that kind of effect. Curtis, you mentioned the rhythms of bossa nova. And mm-hmm. I'm going to have you guys play a song in just a second, but could you just sort of demonstrate on your guitar the kind of rhythm feel that you look for in this kind of music?
Yeah, sure. Well, a couple of things I would say. We were just talking about this a moment ago, right, Chris?
Yeah.
The rhythm is something that's kind of infectious and can be dancey, can be kind of loungy. If I'm playing something like... it's kind of what bossa nova sounds like, you know?
Sure.
And I kind of... I wouldn't say I'm a schooled bossa nova player.
Yeah.
But I love the music, and I've been kind of faking it for a while. And it actually bleeds into a lot of other stuff that I play. So mm-hmm. some of the writing that we do sounds bossa nova-ish and mm-hmm. is kind of inflected with that rhythm. Also... I love the kind of chord progressions and the way that it's unexpected and interesting and, mm-hmm. and kind of dense and just gorgeous. So I've always really loved that about bossa nova.
You've fleshed out your original duo sound with other, what have you got, a couple of horns, some percussion?
Yeah, in the last kind of 5-10 years, we've picked up a bunch of people. We play with a drummer, a bass player who's a great singer. We play with a keyboard player, and we have a small horn section, so mm-hmm. two saxophone players. Sometimes we have a trumpet player come in. For this particular show on Saturday, we're having a percussionist come in, mm-hmm. so a little congas and shaker and stuff like that. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Great. Well, let's hear a song.
Okay.
All right. This is a little Jobim.
Bidarumpao, babarabarabam, bidarumpao, paparabarabam, bidarumpao, barumpai, bambai. Bidarumpao, paparabarabam, bidarumpao, paparabarabam, bidarumpao, bambai, bambai. Yuki samar maishti. Que salva meu coração, mas a amor sabe o segredo. O medo por Marta, o seu coração, água de beber, agua y bebe, camara. Agua y bebe, agua y bebe, camara. Pirarum pao, papararapararum, pirarum pao, patararapararum, pirarum pao, barumba, bamba. Eu nunca fiz coisa tão certa. Entrei pra escola do pedal. A minha casa vive aberta. Abri todas as portas do coração. Hoje bebei água de bebê, camará. Água de bebê. Água de bebê, camará. Água de bebê. Água de bebê, camará. Água de bebê. Água de bebê, camará. Pirarum pau, paparara babaiarão, pirarum pau, paparara babaiarão, pirarum pau, bambai, bambai.
I'd say that was a perfect introduction to you guys' music.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, you can also see why you like it so much, yeah. You know, because that's that song has a nice way of moving right along, doesn't it?
It really does, and I really feel like Bossa Nova suits Annie's voice, you know?
Sure.
She has a really warm, intimate kind of way of singing, and I think it's just about perfect for her.
Yeah, you can't yell, can you?
No.
No, I don't have a very bright voice, like a Broadway music singer. I can if I need to, but normally what I like is I have kind of a dark, moody voice. So we're often, I'm like, let's sing Bossa Nova, because I like my voice in it.
No, it's a really nice blend. Mm-hmm. Thanks to both of you for coming.
Oh, all right. Thank you so much for
having us.
Thank
you for having us.
Curtis Camilla is the leader and Annie Camilla, the vocalist in Mango Season, which will be performing in our Atherton studio this Saturday at 7:30.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Urgent Care Hawaii. Walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, featuring ZipPass, a new online tool to secure a place in line. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
The Hawaii Technology Development Corp wants to build a training center for police and first responders. But does that fulfill the organization's mission? It may come down to how lawmakers view tech. Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton has today's reality check. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Beth Ann.
So this looks kind of different from what we all thought a tech park was going to be.
Yes, it's when you look at the definition in the statute about the Hawaii Technology Development Corporation's mission, the definition of high technology includes things like electronics, biotech, software development, that sort of thing. This isn't that.
No, it's not that, but I mean, some way you could kind of conceivably back end in some of that stuff to what happens with both first responders and police. Is that where that nexus is?
That seems to be how the executive director is interpreting this. Her answer was that, yes, first responders use technology and use cutting-edge technology, and therefore that use fulfills the statutory purpose of the HTDC.
Would there be any room for, say, scientists or engineers or other tech folks?
Well, it looks like it. The OETS, which is the state's technology service, is going to have an operation there, and HTDC plans to have space for something there, but that only, according to the preliminary plan, is about 10% of the built space. The rest will be for other things. And again, even the other things, like DOD, might be using having some kind of scientists or tech people there. We just don't know how much will be dedicated to that.
Kind of why they're calling it the Cybersecurity and First Responder Tech Park, eh?
Yes. Well, again, we just don't know how much is actually going to be dedicated to cybersecurity.
So knowing, though, that there is the possibility of saying having, you know, the FBI there, does that mean that getting them involved could translate into potential cash for the project?
Possibly. At this point, though, the FBI and NSA and other federal agencies just haven't said one way or the other whether they'll be involved.
When will we know how this project is continuing?
Well, that we don't know. What we can say is that earlier this month, the board approved acquiring land for about $10 million, and the site's about 150 acres out in Mililani. So that much we do know. Moving forward, there's a lot of work to be done.
What's the next step?
The next step will be to a number of steps. They need to find a master planner. They need to come up with a final plan and other things. But again, the focus right now is on the sale. They do need to, or the acquisition of the land, they need to close on that and actually acquire the land. The board has approved that, but they need to acquire the land.
All right. After that, we should really see what's going to happen on it. Thanks a lot, Stuart.
Thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org. Today, featuring reporter Stuart Yurton.
The students at Northport High are like most high schoolers in America. When they grow up, they want to be somebody.
In 10 years, I will plan on being
a doctor, lawyer,
a millionaire.
And their principal, George Kenney, was totally behind them. So much so that he turned to an unusual strategy to help them get there. Hypnosis. What went right and then horribly wrong? This week on Invisibilia.
Saturday at 4 p.m. following the TED Radio Hour.
Few would argue that Hawaii's issues with invasive species aren't being met with real effort to keep mainland hitchhiking pests from taking hold. A state audit is trying to help inspectors to better and more easily do their jobs and with a higher rate of predictable success. The recent audit of the plant quarantine branch shows ineffective practices and systems and possible remedies. State Auditor Les Kondo recently sat down with me to look more deeply into the findings by his office.
We examined one function of the branch, and that is, as you described, it's to detect and stop invasive pests that are coming from the U.S. mainland from coming into the state. And so what we found in our audit is we found that the branch and the inspectors, they're only able to inspect a very, very small percentage of the incoming cargo, less than 2.5%. They simply can't inspect everything. So what we found the inspectors to be doing is they're inspecting using old, outdated inspection methods. Many inspectors describe their process as handing down information that they learned, their personal experiences, from inspector to inspector. One inspector actually described it as caveman style, handing information down from inspector to inspector.
So let me ask you this, because in different industries, including, say, the insurance industry, they can't go through and talk to absolutely everybody, but being able to do sort of risk assessments, who you would be more likely to talk to, who might be more predisposed to being in a certain circumstance. Is that not the same idea, or is that idea not being at all used when we're trying to look for invasives?
You know, that idea is exactly what we felt the department needed to do. They needed to move into a current 21st century process using current modern tools we see that the USDA and other foreign jurisdictions that are similar to Hawaii in the sense that they're isolated islands like Australia, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, they are using data-based or data-driven risk-based assessment to help most efficiently direct and deploy their resources to stop the pests that are more likely to be coming in, inspecting the produce, the commodities, the imports that are most likely to be pathways or the way that invasive species are coming into their jurisdictions.
Right now, we seem to spend a lot of time talking about pests that might hitchhike on produce, and especially given all the attention to rat lungworm, people are looking at their produce a little differently, but maybe not the plants that are coming in. And yet it would seem like those would be the places where we might find more of them. Certainly we see that with Christmas trees sometimes. But when you're talking about bringing in live plants and live plants that are meant for people to purchase and put into their own gardens, it would seem logical to be looking at those, wouldn't it?
I think the department or the branch would agree with that. I think in 2014, the branch had actually done a study, and that study confirmed exactly what you're saying, that really the pathway for most of these invasive species that actually are able to survive and actually thrive in the state, they're coming in through plants, through nursery products, through promulgated material. They're not coming in through produce, through the apples or the tomatoes necessarily. They're really coming in through the plants and the nursery materials. And like you said, I think if we look at the invasive species or the pests that have actually gained a toehold since 2007, it's the coqui frog. It's the coconut rhinoceros beetle. It's Rapidohia death. We see the little red fire ant. And it seems logical, more common sense, that those insects, those pests, those species, invasive species, they're coming in through the plant material and not through the commerce.
So, Las Condo, how do we get to the point where we're doing something that is both easier to do, potentially, and that would be far more effective?
Well, the department or the branch has to move into the 21st century. They have to use tools that are modern, current tools so that they can do a data-based, risk-based assessment so they can deploy their inspectors. They have a very few inspectors given the volume of cargo that's coming in, but they have to make a much more thoughtful, meaningful way to deploy those inspectors to inspect and look at the imports that are most likely to contain those pests.
What does that mean money-wise? What does that mean for changing over the system that they've been using for, 10 years or so?
I think actually the department has tried to move into this effort of doing a database risk-based assessment. It's just unfortunate that the tool that they have tried to develop over 10 years, I think they've spent over $4.2 million to develop this database that they call Invicta. It just has not worked. So the department has told us that going forward, they are in the process of soliciting bids to develop a new system that hopefully will work better and will actually serve as the 21st century data hub that is necessary to do biosecurity in today's world.
Clearly, though, there must be models for that. I mean, people have heard about money being thrown into new systems that wind up not getting them very much, perhaps the same way in which Invicta had good ideas behind it but wasn't able to really produce at the level that you were hopeful that it would. What might be out there that means we don't have to necessarily reinvent it?
Boy, I don't know the answer to that question. I sure hope that the department and more specifically the branch and actually the inspectors that are going to use the system, that they have been involved in exploring the different options and involved with whatever and will be involved with whatever the consultant or the vendor that gets chosen to develop the system so that the system that is developed works for them. I think it's extremely important, and I think that's one of the problems with the current system, Invicta, is that it doesn't do what it's supposed to do, but also, as importantly, it has become very burdensome for the inspectors to use the system. And because of that, the inspectors have been allowed to do things, input interception data that is not meaningful. Instead of the specific commodity, for instance, or the specific pests that they've intercepted, they've been allowed, because of the burden on them to input specific information, they've been allowed to input general information. Instead of the specific type of fruit, for instance, an apple, specific type of apple from a specific state, they've been allowed to input the produce as fruit or apple. And that kind of information that doesn't include the specific detail, it's not meaningful. It cannot help them as they do risk assessment.
Hearing the fact that they're just logging it as fruit, not even apple, but just fruit, seems to be so nonsensical for anyone who would be trying to truly prevent these kinds of invasives from coming in. You must have found this shocking.
I think what we found is we found that they're doing things in a way that they could improve upon.
You're being very politic with that.
I think really our job isn't to put our personal feelings into things. We're assessing whether or not they could improve their operations. And we make recommendations that we think are reasonable, that are meaningful, that they can actually do to do better.
Right. But from the standpoint of everyone who is told that we need to be so careful about what we bring back into the state, the fact that, you know, you go someplace and your suitcase is going to be screened if you're going off or you're coming back. And many people who are saying, but that doesn't even make sense either, because now you're screening for maybe fruit or something that may probably not even have those pests associated with them, unlike, say, plants coming in. And this high sensitivity that many people have in Hawaii to trying to protect what comes in seems to be thwarted by the fact that we have an inspection process that doesn't meet the needs of the state. You could not answer that if you want, but
I don't know really how to answer that. I think the inspector.
But ironic, isn't it?
Well, I think the inspectors, they're trying to do a good job. They're really trying to stop invasive pests from coming in. It's just they have not been given the necessary tools to be able to inspect more appropriately, more effectively, more efficiently. They're opening luggage. They're opening boxes of tomatoes, for instance, rather than being deployed to look at plant material that's coming in. It's more likely that if there's an invasive pest or an invasive species, it's coming through that medium. So to answer your question, I think they're trying. I think that the actual inspectors themselves, I just don't think the department has equipped them with the necessary tool. They're trying to do that now, but the tool that they have in place just doesn't work.
So they're being hampered in being able to do the job that we'd all like them to do, which is to keep these invasives from coming into Hawaii.
Certainly an important job.
Les Kondo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Les Kondo was executive director and the chief legal counsel at the Hawaii State Ethics Commission and stepped down last year to serve as state auditor.
Hi, I'm Santiago Torres from Santa Barbara, California. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we remembered a mainland businessman who married into royalty and played an important role in the affairs of the 19th century Kingdom of Hawaii. He came to the islands at the age of 24 to seek his fortune and married into royalty a few years later. His bride was Bernice Pauahi Paki of the Royal House of Kamehameha, whom he married in 1850. At first, her family objected, but he soon became a valued member of the family and a key advisor to 19th century Hawaiian monarchs. Upon his wife's death, he carried forth her wishes as one of the first trustees of and a major donor to the Kamehameha schools. He also was a founder of the Bernice Pauahi Bishop Museum, which he named after his late wife. He also donated funds for buildings at the private Punahou School. His name was Charles Reed Bishop.
And Elizabeth Alsbrook knew that, called us from Kaneohe, and will be receiving our tote bag to let everyone know that she got it right. That's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Katie Horner is a history teacher at Belleville East High School in Belleville, Illinois, who came to Hawaii to deliver a eulogy at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific for sailor Bruce Dean Bradley, who was serving aboard the USS Arizona during the Pearl Harbor attack. Her work is part of a nationwide history project called Understanding Sacrifice, and we talked with her about her effort to revive the memory of a fallen hero.
Bruce Dean Bradley was from, he was born in Paw Paw, Illinois, which is a rural town, in northern Illinois. And his mother was sick and had to leave the family for a while. So his father sent him to Elgin, Illinois, to live with his sister and brother-in-law, and she essentially raised him. He made it through 2.5 years of high school at Elgin High School and then decided to join the United States Navy. In October of 1940, he joined as an apprentice seaman and trained at the Great Lakes Naval Training Station there, and then was later transferred out to San Diego, where he eventually ended up on the USS Arizona on December 9th, 1940, almost a year to the day from when it was attacked. He was elevated to a seaman second class, and there he served until December 7th, 1941, when the Arizona was sunk. His body was never recovered. It took about a month for the family to finally receive official word that they were considering him deceased. His sister, Laura, the one who essentially raised him, wrote repeated letters to the Navy asking for any indication that he might be alive. Did they find any personal belongings? And actually, 3 years after he died and they declared him dead, she was still writing letters asking even for a flag, any kind of memorial of him. He was 19 when he died, so he didn't have a chance to get married or have children. He was a son and a brother, and he had 4 siblings that missed him terribly. They're all now deceased as well. So through the course of my research, I was fortunate enough to find some descendants of his, some great nieces and nephews. Much of the letters and even the Purple Heart that he was awarded were lost over time. So one of his great nieces actually petitioned the Navy to have a new Purple Heart issued, and it was denied initially because they only reissue those to immediate family members, but all of his siblings are deceased, and he doesn't have children. So she took it up the chain and went to President Obama and wrote repeated letters to President Obama, who eventually said, I think you should be able to get one of these, and told that to the Navy, and they did, in fact, reissue him, his family, a Purple Heart that she then gave to his namesake.
There are a lot of stories within the story here, aren't there? And one of them is just the sheer chaos at Pearl Harbor after the attack.
Right. The countless men that and women that just were lost for a time, you know, families hearing of the attack and desperate for information. And, you know, in an era where they didn't have the quick communications that we do today, that was cumbersome. And it took some time to even just get any closure as to what was going on with your loved one. And the Bradleys were on the losing side of that, never got their brother back, never, you know, had that closure of a body. And but they did put a memorial to him in his hometown where he was born. There's a headstone there, and then there's also a veterans memorial honoring him. So they've continued to try to remember him and losing him at such a young age.
One of the other stories being a very determined family.
Yes, there's actually now a bill that is going to be introduced in Congress to try to streamline the replacement of lost medals for families. The different branches of the military handle this in different ways. And so this Congressman Kind is his name, is trying to make this a little bit more uniform and easier so that families can get those Purple Hearts or whatever medal that sometimes gets misplaced over time through generations, but was still significant to the family, and they should be able to have a piece of that. So that's kind of a legacy to him that he's helping out other families still today.
Well, you know, as a historical researcher, the way one story can be representative of so many thousands of others, and this is clearly that kind of story, isn't it?
It is. Bruce, when I was doing my research on Bruce, what I kept, you know, I would run into a dead end sometimes and not find that letter that I was seeking out. And rather than being frustrated, it made me realize that there are so many men. I was so glad I was seeking out his story, because there's so many men and women whose story is not being sought out.
Mm-hmm.
So he represents so many of those young men that, you know, missed out on that next step in life to have children and have spouses. And so I'm glad that I was able to give a little life to this story. It's been a great program that we've been involved in. We've visited already in San Francisco. We visited two different cemeteries that the National Cemetery Administration runs, and they've got the Walls of the Missing, and they've got these. We've gone to the gravesite of other fallen heroes and given eulogies, and it's just been such a wonderful way to remember them. I'm grateful to them and to the American Battle Monuments Commission. They've done a great job putting these programs together to remember our fallen soldiers.
Well, one of the other things that it reminds us of is that, you know, we often speak of the resilience of the Second World War generation, and it's pretty difficult from the point of view of today to imagine a situation as catastrophic as the Second World War, where there probably wasn't a family in America that was not somehow affected.
Absolutely. Whether you sent somebody, a loved one, overseas, or whether you had somebody at home working to build machines and uniforms, or, you know, any part of the home front industry, we were all in one way or another in that era really supporting that war effort. And I think that Pearl Harbor being attacked, you know, on our home soil really just unified this nation in a way that nothing in my lifetime has seen.
Do you think we still, as a society, have that kind of resilience within us?
I do. I mean, 9/11 was absolutely a unifying event for a time in our country. You know, I think we saw everybody pulling together and appalled that something horrible could happen on our home soil. I just don't think we had the, you know, it didn't turn into something like World War II. It didn't turn into the same kind of war. I just think warfare has changed so much that it might not be a war that unifies us in that way. It could be something different. But I think that we saw glimpses of that with 9/11 and how protective we are of our country and of our citizens. And I do think that that is still there. And it's something that I try to illustrate to my students, that time and again in history, it's not just a war that can unify us. We've had different events in our lives throughout the course of history that has unified the United States in many different ways. And deep down, Americans are very proud of who they are. And when it's threatened, I think we pull together. And I truly believe that that still exists.
Katie Horner teaches history at Belleville East High School in Belleville, Illinois. She's one of 18 middle and high school educators around the country taking part in Understanding Sacrifice, an 18-month program to share knowledge about America's role in the Pacific Theater of Operations during the Second World War, and to create eulogies for men and women lost in that conflict.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and our Morning Edition host Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today, what have we got under the radar, Derek?
Okay, we have a monthly book club meeting tomorrow on the Big Island, the Friends of the Library Kona Book Club will meet on the lanai of the Kailua Kona Library. This is happening tomorrow at 11 a.m. This month's selection is Madam Secretary, a memoir by Madeleine Albright, and this is free.
And if you haven't read it yet, you better hurry.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
And then you can always buy a book instead of borrow one, right?
Right. The Friends of the Hawaii Kai Public Library, they often hold book sales. And for this month, for July, all religion and self-help books are 50% off. This is happening all this month at the Hawaii Kai Community Bookstore at Hawaii Kai Public Library. The library is closed on Friday and Sunday.
All the more reason to get down there.
Mm-hmm.
And at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park is hosting a Hawaiian music concert tomorrow night.
The Nawai Chamber Orchestra is based in Honolulu. The women's vocal group celebrates the works of women, preserving native Hawaiian music of the past and present. This concert takes place at 7 p.m. tomorrow in the Kilauea Visitor Center Auditorium. It's free, but park entrance fees apply.
Something to keep you busy on the Big Island.
There you go. A concert on a Tuesday night. How's that?
That's right. Thanks, Derek. Mm-hmm. Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more about said events on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Thanks so much for joining us for the conversation today. Tomorrow, Hawaii will respond to the motion filed by the federal government over the latest travel ban. Opinion of Judge Watson. Attorney General Douglas Chin will join us to talk about the state's answer.
And there's a powerful drama at Chaminade marking the 25th anniversary of the Rodney King riots.
You can always email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you back here tomorrow for more of The Conversation.